and want to say just a couple more things in conclusion and then leave it open to whatever questions or comments you may have. Or I've just talked about a couple of the themes that were in this very rich chapter, so there may be other things that came home to you as more pertinent that you would want to share. But in terms of concluding the story of the Jesus and the Canaanite woman, I think what's happening here is that the gospel is inviting us to convert from a fear-centered place to a love-centered place. And that's I've always thought that we hear a lot in the church about the division between conservatives and liberals or progressives and so forth. I've always experienced that to be a very unhelpful criteria for understanding what we're called to do as a gospel people, because there's one sense in which we're always about conserving the tradition that we have received. Jesus was very much a person of tradition, someone who was steeped in the prophets and steeped in the law of his own tradition, and who his interpretations of that law and of the prophets were very much based on his love of the tradition in which he had been raised. And yet there's also very much a part of the gospel that is future-centered. In the time of Jesus, there was that sense of the future fulfillment of time breaking in very, very quickly. And so in the Lord's Prayer we pray, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. That's a future-centered prayer. And so we're challenged in a way to preserve tradition while at the same time greeting the future with hope, reading the signs of the times, which is one of the things that Jesus talks about, as Jesus does, going into strange territory and entering into dialogue there, being willing to listen and being willing to converse. So what I think is a better criteria for understanding who we are to be as a gospel people is not the conservative versus progressive thing, but fear-centered versus love-centered. I think we're, John the 23rd, I think, was a profoundly conservative person. In many ways, he was very old-fashioned. He loved old-fashioned furniture. He loved the pomp and circumstance of the old liturgy. He liked to dress in kind of old-fashioned ways. But what was really, I think, exceptional about Pope John the 23rd was he seemed to be a person who was absolutely devoid of fear. Somehow or another, in the course of his 77 years, fear had been broken apart in him in such a way that what remained was a very love-centered existence. And so you think back to the things that were so compelling about John the 23rd was that he came from a place of love. That was the thing that was, I think, his message to all of us was to live not from a place of fear, but from a place of love. That's the message of Jesus as well, I think, is to live not from a place of fear, but from a place of love. And in this story, we see Jesus kind of living out this kind of conversion from being fear-centered to being love-centered. Now, how do we, you know, the sense of, one of the things that I try to do, you know, in terms of my own life, because this is very much, I'm a person who struggles with fear, and these are, you know, some of the qualities that I experience in terms of being fear-centered. One is where there's a lot of fear, there's usually a lot of anger, and I'm trying to think of his name, Michael Lerner. Michael Lerner is a Jewish scholar who is the editor of a magazine called Tikkun, and he's just written a book, and I think it's called The Left Hand of God. And he really explores in this, from a Jewish perspective, this whole question of fear and how much in our society we live from a place of fear. And one of the characteristics he uses about fear is greed. that when we're afraid, one of the things that we're trying to do is accumulate as much as possible. And we talk sometimes about acquiring a lot of stuff as a response to the fear of death, which is symbolized in that bumper sticker, the one with the most toys, or the one who dies with the most toys wins. We're afraid of death. This is a way that if we accumulate all of these things around us, somehow they're going to protect us. So one aspect of a fear-centered life is greediness. Rigid thinking, I think, in terms of my own life, this is the sort of, kind of thing, seeing the world in blacks and whites and in stereotypes. My experience with this, young man who came in last night. He was a stranger who burst into my group, so I was kind of responding to him in terms of all of the stereotypes that I have of the unknown, rather than really wanting to get to know who he was as a person. Aggression, aggressive behavior, I think is really fear-centered. Why is it that we're so, I often wonder about this, why is it that we are so aggressive when we get behind the wheel of a car? I think apart from the fact that we can't see the person in the other car, so they're kind of anonymous to us, we can't really relate to them as persons. It's a dangerous thing driving a car, so we're afraid. And in our fear, we become aggressive. And I think it's symbolized by all of these, SUVs and these big Hummers and all of these things, I mean, you look at these things and they're like tanks. They're built for war, And, what are we saying when we do this? We're saying, stay away from me, If you're gonna smash into me, you're the one that's gonna suffer. And we tend to say that in terms of our foreign policy too. I think a lot. That's kind of where we're coming from, because it tends to be fear-centered. We're self-protective. That's another aspect, I think, of a fear-centered way of approaching things. We're self-protective. We want to preserve everything the way it is. We can take that kind of attitude towards the church, where the church becomes a fortress, or as John the 23rd once said, a museum, where what we're trying to do is protect everything as much as possible to keep it from, being hurt or destroyed. What are the qualities of being love-centered? One of the things that we see in Jesus is that he has this amazing capacity to look beyond the externals to see into the heart of people. I think that's a quality of a love-centered life. So we're willing to look beyond the externals to see into the hearts of people, to read the hearts of people. A sense of humor, I think, is very much a part. That was certainly, one of the great gifts of John the 23rd. We missed a lot of the humor in the Gospels because it's a different culture. But if you you understand some of those Gospel stories, there's a wonderful humor in them, including the story today. What's really happening in this story is this very clever woman is outwitting Jesus. And he realizes and he understands that what is happening is he's being outmaneuvered here. And he accepts the humor of that and responds to it. We can miss that, but it's very much there in the story. Quality of being love-centered is compassion. And Michael Crosby uses that wonderful word, which I not really have thought about that much, pathos. He talks about the pathos of God. We use mostly the opposite of that, apathetic, which means without pathos. That depth of passion, that God cares deeply about us. God cares deeply about us. And when we see a person who has that kind of pathos, that cares deeply, that's something that we respond to. One of the qualities of a love-centered life, I think, is that people who are love-centered are very encouraging. And if you're around somebody who comes from a love place, they're very encouraging people. They make you feel better about yourself, and they make you link in with the potential that you have. Barnabas in the Gospel, actually the Apostle, the friend of Paul, is called the son of encouragement. To give courage to others. I think that's one of the things that we're really called to be for each other, is to be encouragers for one another. And we can't do that unless we're love-centered. A creative imagination, I think, is a quality of a love-centered life, the ability to kind of relax into the moment and allow the spirit to listen to the spirit. One of the amazing things about Jesus to me in the Gospels is so often, you know, he's got these people that trap him, you know, so he has to answer either A or B, and there's no other way he can get out of it. And all of a sudden he comes up with an answer that's completely unlike what anyone else would have thought of, because he's thinking on a different level. He has access to that spirit within him. And, you know, sometimes we have that experience where we're struggling with something and we just can't come up with the answer to it. And all of a sudden, you know, we sleep on it and it just comes to us. And it's so wonderfully clear and true. And you say, why didn't I think of that before? And that somehow or another, at that moment, our hearts are open to the spirit. And the imagination is the way that the spirit speaks to us very often. Quality of love-centered life, other-directed. Jesus is, you know, the person for others. Not self-protective, not thinking about what am I going to get out of this, and what, you know, what's the advantage for me, but other-directed. And capacity for sacrifice. We certainly see this in the life of Jesus. The willingness to lay down one's life for one's friends, or to lay down one's life for someone who is not a friend, somebody who we don't know. When we see someone who does this, it makes a powerful impact on us, because we sense that there's something holy in that. So those are some of the qualities, I think, of a love-centered life. I think our task in life as gospel people is to move from that place of fear-centered, which our whole society is telling us that's where we should live. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, within the church, we've dealt with a lot of fear-centered stuff within the church. The fear of hell being used to, get us to do certain things and so forth, or our fear of the stranger in different ways. But there's also, you know, always within the church, people who are struggling to move to this love-centered place. And we encourage one another in being able to do that in a way that's faithful to the gospel story that we read today. Let me stop there and see what questions you might have or comments that you would like to make. Yes.
Why do you think Jesus went into Tyre that he wasn't willing or didn't realize that he would be talking with the enemy, so to speak, the Canaanite woman?
Mm-hmm.
He had gone there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, initially, what the Gospels present is that initially Jesus' understanding was that he would bring the good news of the kingdom of God to the Jews. And he would go where Jews were, and the boundaries of these places were somewhat porous at this time, particularly with, you know, the influence of the Romans in the world at that time and the areas that they covered, and so people could move back and forth. But as Jesus goes into some of these territories, like Samaria or the Gentile territories, he might be speaking with the Jews who live in those areas, but also inevitably going into that territory puts him in touch with Gentiles. And what the story tells us is that he responds to that. You know, initially. I mean, what I like about this story is that, you know, it presents a picture of Jesus that we don't like to imagine, because we think of Jesus as being perfect. On the other hand, it presents a picture of Jesus that's very much, I'll just speak for myself, that's very much like me. So when I see the story and the conversion that Jesus goes through, my question there is not, does this mean Jesus is a bad person, but how can I go through that same conversion of moving from a fear-centered place to a love-centered place? Yes.
It seems like the times of Jesus when they were occupied by Rome, the Jews were occupied, it's similar to what's happened in Iraq today. We are the occupiers.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid of us.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand us, and we don't understand them.
Mm-hmm.
We need the Jesus Mm-hmm. You know, we need more than some Messiah, somebody to save that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And who's that going to be?
Everyone.
Tom?
I've been playing with the merciful, the idea of have mercy as you develop in that Canaanite story. And I've been thinking about where we use that formula habitually in the Mass. I can think of two places. I can think of course, that at the beginning, the Kyrie, which is Lord, have mercy, and then Christe. And then you go back to Kyrie, Lord, have mercy. I've never been entirely comfortable with that and wonder whether we're asking God or Lord to have a conversion toward us. Are we parodying, in other words, the Canaanite woman in that prayer?
Mm-hmm.
And the other other point I can think of, maybe you can comment on that, but the other one that I think of is, you know, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, again, have mercy on us. Mm-hmm. So we certainly say that a lot, but we don't think about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate what you're saying, but can you reflect a little on that,
man? Yeah, that's a good. As Michael Crosby points out in his book, that you know the term mercy, you know, kind of floats through. It's woven into the structure of the liturgy, so that we're kind of living with that word throughout. And I used for the story today, I used the translation of the New Revised Standard Version because. The woman says, have mercy, and the American Bible says, have pity, which to our ears says something very different. At least to my ears, that says something different than mercy. And it's interesting that they chose that particular word. I think you're right that we are in saying Lord have mercy. We're saying the exact same words that the woman says in the story. And I guess the sense in that is that we are trusting, as the woman does, that we will indeed receive the mercy of God as people who are coming with our brokenness as well as our blessedness. Before the Lord, but it probably doesn't speak sufficiently of the our belief that the mercy of God is there for us before we ask for it. You know, the story of the prodigal son, which we move to the Gospel of Luke rather than Matthew, but the son who comes up. The father doesn't even listen to his words. He's got a very carefully rehearsed speech that he's going to do, which is basically saying, Father, have mercy on me. Yeah, but it's longer speech. And the father doesn't even have interest in listening to the speech. He just wants to love his son and embrace him and celebrate with him. And that's our belief about God. And I think liturgical texts are very much a compromise, I think, between different points of view about how much we receive God's mercy right away and how much we have to work to get it. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes?
I like Michael Crosby's statement on page 120. Says mercy fulfills justice. It's not just a dimension of justice, and that Jesus is the incarnation or revelation of mercy, a central characteristic of God's perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really like this idea that it fulfills justice, not just a dimension of it.
Mm-hmm.
There is no justice
mm-hmm.
without mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love your analogy of the March of the Penguins, because if we really, especially with this new appreciation that we're gaining for our evolutionary history and how if we look at the principles that have guided our evolution so far that the human species has grown out of, here's a revelation of God that says God cares for the smallest, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that God provides for the whole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so at the human level, we can look at this and see the mercy and compassion of God. I mean,
mm-hmm.
humans don't understand mercy and
mm-hmm.
compassion, but as
mm-hmm.
humans now,
mm-hmm.
we have an awareness that God cares for the smallest and provides
mm-hmm.
for all.
Mm-hmm.
It's those flowers mm-hmm. up on the the piano there, Lynn Carman gave me, and you know, I'm looking at those. I've never seen them before. I forget what they're called.
Yeah.
Look at how exquisite. I mean, when you see how Bach provides variety, you know, and now we're growing into this awareness of it, but I loved your analogy with the preservation of the whole being, in other words, the individual can't be changed alone.
Together,
or not
when one suffers, the whole suffers. The community suffers.
But it's also the image of community where which you ended up with. The idea being, all those pedagogues are all together, but there are the people out here who aren't a part of even those. The circle on the end. You think just parish-wise, you have that situation when we eventually have to come to that circle.
And I think that's part of the message that we have in the Gospels, is that God's circle is a continually expanding one, that there is no boundary, really. God has no boundaries. So the circle is always being pushed out further and further, and the way that happens is through those on the edge coming into the center. But it keeps, you know, God has no limits to compassion. That's part of that pathos.
I want to thank you for this, Joe. The challenge for me is, how do I take small steps to get out of my territory and get into an uncomfortable territory? Mm-hmm. Christ had that ability to move into the Phoenician area.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes we don't want to get into that Phoenician area.
Mm-hmm.
How often do I use my religion to shrink my circle?
Mm-hmm.
Who do I invite to my table?
Mm-hmm.
When I go to church on Sunday or whenever, do I really believe all are welcome?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess those are the four, right? And touch.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I expand incrementally? I can't jump from my gated community, you know, to the Sudan. But how do I just expand that so that I feel like I'm living the gospel more today than when I walk in here at 10 o'clock?
That's a very good question. How would you answer that question? I think you've got the right idea. It's one step at a time.
Just
to push a little further ahead.
It's a process. Christianity is a process.
It's a process, absolutely. Some people have, let's see, you haven't talked to them.
I have an answer. Go to our nursing home. Talk about uncomfortable territory. Go to places where people have no business during the year, who are so needy and so lonely.
Very good. Somebody over here has
I also have a beginning solution to this gentleman. I work downtown and live in Goleta, and I started taking the number 8 bus.
Mm-hmm.
You want an education, you want an opportunity to minister to people, ride the number 8 bus. Well, the number 8 bus goes through the county health center, the alcohol and drug abuse place, the veterans place, by the county jail, where they, every week, people are released on Monday morning and get on that bus.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those people just need someone to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's amazing. I've always been in a very sheltered little environment, like Father was saying. You go to your church groups, your kids are growing up, you're in the PTA with all these people, and it is scary to reach out, but I tell you, that would be a real education for you to ride that bus.
Too many suggestions.
to move out into unfamiliar territory and have it modeled for us, and, you know, in, with all respect, I think that Pope John Paul II was a fearful person. I think he feared the loss of Catholic identity. And if you look at encyclicals, the only references in encyclicals are the previous encyclicals or to the catechism. There is never any reference, even when you're talking on topics where science might have something to offer as a stranger in the field out there that you might want to be in conversation with. I don't think the Church, in a sense, has modeled very well that we, other than we have missionaries, but the Church goes to bring what we believe to other people, not to go to hear other people and learn from them. I wonder, you know, how greatly that was modeled even by Pope John Paul II. I think there was a great fear that Catholic identity would be lost if, in fact, it changed, or if, in fact, something new was added, or if, in fact, we actually embrace Buddhist ideas, I mean, that is in the Church, but not coming from the institutional Church. If that lack of fear would have been modeled more for us, maybe we would have felt freer to go and learn from, you know, other developments or other faiths.
This past Sunday, I was part of a kind of a panel of response to a film at the Jewish Film Festival. The film was Sister Rose's Passion, and it was about a Dominican sister in Wisconsin who was in education, and in the 1950s began to realize that a lot of the references to the Jewish people in the Catholic texts, religious education texts, were very anti-Semitic, and, you know, promoted the very, you know, the sense that Jews killed Jesus and things that were very, very, very harmful. And she responded to that by, you know, becoming an advocate for a more caring approach to the way in which Catholic religious texts dealt with the Jewish people, and it was really kind of a precursor of the Second Vatican Council. In fact, she began doing this in the 1940s and 50s, and she was actually consulted by people like Cardinal Bayer during the Second Vatican Council because she had kind of pioneered in this area. But it was a real example of somebody who, kind of worked out of the environment in which she found herself, saw a way in which there was something that fostered separateness among people, and just worked, she saw this is not the truth, and worked very clearly and very passionately to bring about a change in that. And it was quite impressive to witness this film with a group of, it was a packed theater of people who were, for the most part, Jewish. And just the sense of gratitude that people expressed for the work that Sister Rose had done to bring about a better understanding, among Catholics and Jews. I think it's attributed to Mother Teresa of Calcutta, bloom where you're planted, wherever you find yourself at this particular time. Look at it in terms of where you see separateness that divides people. We have a lot of, right now in the Church, there's the whole question of how men and women, live together as a community of faith and encourage one another's gifts and work together as co-leaders and co-ministers within the Church. We don't know how to do that. And yet, it's evidently a crying need. If you have, a church, I think all of us saw, when Pope John Paul II died, and all of the events leading up to the election of the new pope and so forth, you see these huge crowds of the leaders of the church who are all, you know, all men, you know, at the very highest level. But, you know, but clearly, we, you know, something needs to, you know, how do we enable everyone's gifts to occur? You know, one of the ways I think that that's happening in the church now is through the small communities of faith, or groups like this, where people really are able to kind of take part in a more shared ministry and leadership within the church. But we need to find ways to do that. And, you know, it's not something that's way far out there. We're living with that every day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes?
I'm just thinking along these lines, do you feel free to say what you think about Catholic education? And I'm talking particularly about not college, university, but grammar and high school education, Catholic education.
Uh-huh.
Are we wasting our money?
Well, that's an area where I'm really not a very competent witness, because I don't really know a lot about it. My work is mostly on the college level with a state university campus, and I really haven't really worked a lot with. I've worked in a parish that's had a Catholic school, so my last experience of Catholic education was in high school in the 1960s. So I'm sure things are much different now than they were then. I think that the question that we need to apply with all of these things is that question of what we are teaching the next generation. Is it really conveying a love-centered, gospel-centered Christianity? And you certainly see some difficulties in terms of the number of young people who are no longer practicing as part of a church community. On the other hand, I work with a community of, you know, university students who, you know, I mean, they're a blessing to the future of the church. They're a blessing to the future of the church. And a lot of their formation in Catholic grade schools and high schools has contributed to that, their ability to share their faith and to lead, both the men and women who are, you know, leading in our retreat experiences and so forth. So I suspect it's kind of as like most of the time, a kind of a mixed experience. Yes?
Well, I think I went to a talk, and Father Virgil, I think, said that education in the faith is absolutely, necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the foundation of your belief system, and I don't think you can learn that just going to, classes, confraternity classes, or, learning from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents don't.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so where are you going to learn it?
My experience is that young people are not learning what you and I are learning here.
Mm-hmm.
they're learning the old stuff,
mm-hmm.
pre-Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my sister was educated in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
had the Dutch Catechism, had the benefit of Vatican II.
Yeah.
I was educated prior to that.
Yeah.
Her education was very much different, but then the Dutch Catechism was condemned, and things converted to rigid
forms.
So, I have a lot of questions.
That's the whole thing of, are we trying to protect our identity in a certain way, or are we kind of imbuing people a love-centered Christian message?
But don't we admire that about the Jewish people, that they kept their religion because they were so, tribal about it? I mean, had they been dispersed into the population from all their exile, it might have gone. It might have died with some of the other idolatrous, other kinds of religions.
One of the wonderful things I think that the Jewish tradition has to teach us, that's amazing how this has happened with them, that over the course of time, they have had to transform almost all of their major spiritual or religious symbols. You know, they had an identity with the kings of Israel, and the kings disappeared, and the Ark of the Covenant was a very important central focus point of their faith. It was where the Ten Commandments were held. It disappeared. Nobody knows where it was, unless you believe Steven Spielberg that it's in the basement of the Smithsonian. But, yeah, the temple, you know, the temple was this, you know, very center of the Jewish faith. The temple was destroyed, and the land of Israel, people were, and yet they preserved their sense of identity. And there was, you know, certainly that sense of that we are a people, and that really the fundamental thing that we preserve is the sense that we are a people who, you know, God cares for, God has pathos for. That's a very powerful, and, you know, we're looking today at radical changes in the way that our churches, you know, it looks like it's a possibility that we will no longer have priests the way we had priests a few years ago, and that seems unthinkable, you know, the Jewish people have a lot to teach us in terms of the way in which they've responded to having to give up things that you would never have thought that they would be able to give up, and yet finding an essential core that has kept them going with a sense of resilience and hope. So a lot of dying and rising again in that. Yeah. Yes?
Do you know of very many Jews that become Christians?
Have very many Jewish become Christians?
There are finally some that have become Christians.
Do I know of any Jewish people who become Christians?
Yes.
Oh yeah, there are lots of Jewish people who become Christians, and I don't think we expect folks to become Christians. Teaching of the Second Vatican Council is that the Jewish people have their covenant, and that when they are being faithful to the covenant that God has given them, they're doing what God intends for them to do. I think personally that one of the really key things that is beginning to happen right now, and that would be very helpful in the future, is that we as Christians understand better the heritage of Jesus as a Jewish rabbi. You know, the fact that Jesus was never a Christian. He never would have regarded himself as a Christian. Yeah. He lived and died as a Jew, and Paul lived and died as a Jew. The Gospels weren't written when Paul died. Paul never saw a Bible. Paul never saw the New Testament, except for the letters that he wrote. Yes.
One of the nicest little girls I know was Jewish, who converted at UCSB through the Bakemark group. Mm-hmm. And I would say her greatest attribute is gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
She is the sweetest, the nicest, the most grateful person I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Everything possibly
could be
is filled with gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a beautiful thing.
Gratitude is probably another one of those virtues of the love-centered life. I didn't mention that, but I think that's a very good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Alan, what did you say in the beginning of that exactly that Father Bird said sacraments, you're not saved by the sacraments, but what did exactly that mean?
You don't need the sacraments to be saved.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, when we were talking about our identity, like our separateness, and mm-hmm. you know, this, I think you basically said what I'm about to say right before this last question or this last comment, but in thinking about the church and, you know, feeling the growing pains, or you bring up Catholic education, you know, mm-hmm. I just had a grade school in high school, and I just had a big chat about the Bible with somebody last night saying I really didn't feel the Bible was opened up to me until I got to college. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to be a question of emphasis. So to me, the question I'm thinking of is, who are we? Who are we? And then in talking about the Jewish faith, I think there is a spectrum, you would agree, of Orthodox Jews and cultural Jews. So, I mean, we're talking about the Jewish faith here as if it's sort of a singular thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in our Catholic faith, if we were to ask, if I was to ask my mother, and maybe you would ask your parents, you know, 40 years ago, who are you? Or who are we as Catholics? Their answers would have been maybe different than our answers are here. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the people of God, I think we're coming together more in our church, in small communities, in groups like this. I mean, I don't know how many groups like this there are, but I'm feeling more hope about figuring out who we are now,
mm-hmm.
and not looking outside somewhere, you know, mm-hmm. or not looking to only encyclicals that may have been written, you know, mm-hmm.
without consulting people, or it's like, you know, even looking at the Pope's funeral, if you look at the sea, it's like, well, is this who we are? You know, I mean, I couldn't identify with the images. Yeah. Frankly, I didn't really watch much of them because it just didn't seem to be where I wanted to swim that day, if you know what I'm saying, you know? So, I don't know. I'm not being very articulate here. I felt like, please, God, give me the words to say, you know, that makes sense. But I think that, in here, you know, we are trying to live with God in our way, you know, and the more we spend time together and be present to one another and see the temples that we are of God and experience mm-hmm. that, then the more God's going to reveal God mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. us and to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
And there's always hope. Bob's Rottweiler. A wonderful encyclical on love that's blown right out of the water.
You never know.